Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Canto 10. Can you hear me now? Over here. Canto 10, chapter 13, text 33. Right. Tad. Ichanot prema rasa plutashaya jata nuraga gata manyavo manyavor bakan uduhya dorbi Harirabhya Murdani Granair Vapu Paramam Mudam Te Tadikshanot Prema Rasa Plutashaya Chatanuraga Gatamanya Manyavur Bakan Uduya Dorvi Paribrabhya Murdani Granair Vapu Paramam Mutam Te Tadikshanot prema rasa plutashaya. Jatanuraga gatumanyavur vakan. Uduhya dorbi parirabhya murdani. Granair avapu paramam madam te. Others?
Ladies.
Tat ikshana utprema rasa apluta ashaya.
It's a long compound. In Sanskrit we say samasa. It's a long one. All the thoughts of the cowherd men merged in the mellow of paternal love, which was aroused by seeing their sons. Jata anuraga, experiencing a great longing or attraction. Gata manyavaha, their anger disappeared. Arbakan, their young sons. Uduhya, lifting. Dorabihi, with their arms. Parirabhya, embracing. Murdani, on the head. Granai, by smelling. Lavapu, obtained. Paramam, the highest. Mudam, pleasure. Day, these cowherd men. Translation. At that time, all the thoughts of the cowherd men were merged in the mellow of paternal love, which was aroused by the sight of their sons, experiencing a great attraction. Their anger completely disappearing, they lifted their sons, embraced them in their arms, and enjoyed the highest pleasure by smelling their sons' heads. Purport. After Brahma stole the original cowherd boys and calves, Krishna expanded himself to become the boys and calves again. Therefore, because the boys were actually Krishna's expansions, the cowherd men were especially attracted to them. At first, the cowherd men, who were on top of the hill, were very angry. But because of Krishna, the boys were extremely attractive. And therefore, the cowherd men immediately came down from the hill with special affection. Later, in verses to come, Prabhupada explains that the smelling of the cowherd boys' heads is a sign of great affection from the parents. And a little further into the chapter, the mention of yoga maya is given. But let me start by saying that these leelas are leelas of love. We are a tradition that worships love. There is no tradition in the world that I know of that focuses so much on the nature of love, the varieties of love, the intensities of love, and the different phases of love as the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition. Now, I have studied for years, and I have taught for years in the university, different world religions. I've examined and carefully read into their sacred texts and have enjoyed really going into the depths of different traditions. And I have found what Prabhupada himself said is the case, that there is bhakti at the core of all true religion. There's bhakti at the heart of all true religion. So it is not the case that we should dismiss other traditions. It is not the case that we should not give no credit to other religious traditions. There is something, there is a jewel in each religious tradition of the world. And that jewel is bhakti. Now, when interacting with other persons of other traditions, we should not tell them what their traditions have or what they are, but rather, let me just make sure I can. You can hear me now? Okay, it just sounds so loud. No, it isn't. I've just never heard my voice this way. It sounds kind of spooky. Maybe Swivas has designed it to be that way. I don't know. Anyway. Okay. In any case, world religions, in their own ways, deliver some sacred information about the nature of divine love. But it is true that in the tradition of Krishna Bhakti, we have so many visions of divine love. So many sweet explanations of divine love. But again, we must inquire from others who are devoted to their traditions to find out what it is that they love so much about their traditions. Saint Augustine, in his Confessions, his famous writings, the Confessions, in Latin, in one of them he asks, what do I love when I love my God? And he goes on to explain. This is the question we should ask others when they come and they are eager to interact with us. So what is it that you do love when you love your God? And then we have the opportunity also to say what we love when we love our God. And we can explain all of these different divine personages that interact with Krishna and demonstrate the sweetest and most intimate aspects of the Godhead and how much pleasure this gives to the devotee. This is, we have so much to offer. We have such treasures to give. Here in this lila, in this divine enactment, we have Krishna, the source of divine love, attending to the cowherd boys and the parents of the cowherd boys, to the cows and the calves, and to Brahma, who was just a little bit naughty here. Just a little bit naughty. Of course, he wasn't like Agasura in previous leelas. Agasura was treated very differently, but Brahma was treated here very affectionately. Krishna seemed to entertain Brahma's need for exercising a little power. And Krishna reciprocated in his own loving way, knowing that Brahma truly is ultimately devoted to Krishna, but perhaps had a little lapse in his devotion. But we are a tradition that focuses on love. We describe, as we all know here, we describe five types of relationships with the divine. Five types of loving relationships with the divine. And each one, as we go further up the scale, each one describes a greater connection, a greater intimacy, and a greater intensity. So the first type of relationship is, of course, shantabhava. Shanta means peaceful, or passive, tranquil. And it is a reverential relationship with the divine that is capable of appreciating the great power and great majesty of the divine. Some of the Goswamins don't even count this first rasa as a real rasa because there is no reciprocation there. So in other words, we may love, say, a great personage in society like Michael Jordan. There you go. Michael Jordan, baseball player, right? Oh, basketball, whatever. Hey, I'm not an expert in sports, okay? Whatever he is. Okay, so we may love him and admire him, but we are doing so from a reverential place. And Mike, I'm on a first name basis with him, Mike does not know us and return that love. It's a love of reverence and admiration. Perhaps like a subject for an emperor. So this is one reason why the Goswamins may not fully give a complete rasa status to Shanta. On the other hand, Shanta Bhava is very powerful in the intimate leelas of Krishna. The gopikas, the Vraja gopikas, who are on the highest level of rasa, the most intense and most intimate level of rasa, the Shringara rasa, they are jealous of the flute Krishna plays because his lips are so close to the flute. And the flute is Shanta Rasa. So there's a real reversal there. There is a way that the rasas have a kind of intermixture. They're not strict categories. The paternal rasa, Vatsalya Rasa, which is the penultimate rasa, has its own type of intensity of intimacy, but there, you know, mixing with the cowherd boys, there's a kind of mixture of the Sakya rasa with the Vatsalya rasa, and then there's, of course, Dasya rasa. The Goswamins outline these very intimate relationships that express the intensity of affection for the divine. Now, ultimately, we understand that prema, pure love, purest love, comes from Krishna, who's the source of love. So we can agree with the Johannine expression in Christianity, that is to say, the Gospel of John, when he says, God is love. God is love. I don't think anyone here would disagree with that. And this leela, among so many other leelas, are expressions of God's love and expressions of his great associates and personages reciprocating that love. But love begins with Krishna. But Krishna himself is subsumed by that love. So we don't only say God is love, but we also reverse it. We say love is God. Because love controls even God. Krishna is most enthralled by the greatest Vrajagopika, that is to say, Radha. And she attracts Krishna in a way that just stuns Krishna. Her love is something that stuns Krishna. And so he is just he is just unable to resist her love. And he wants to understand this love and comprehend this love and reciprocate this love. Even prior to understanding Radha's love, we can understand even in the Rasa Panchadhyayi that the Vrajagopikas themselves stun Krishna in their love and their devotion to Krishna. Love keeps conquering one another. Love conquers both members within a loving relationship. So, in understanding these loving leelas, we have to understand that love comes from Krishna, but that love itself conquers Krishna. And this is the thing we worship most. We worship Krishna for sure. We worship Radha and Krishna for sure. There they are, some of the most beautiful deity worship I've ever seen in my life. Over these 45 years of gazing upon the divine forms of Radha and Krishna. But they themselves are conquered by love. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati in the Brahma Samhita paints a whole picture, a whole kind of geometry of the spiritual world. Or is it Jiva Goswami? I think it's Bhaktisiddhanta. I'm sort of conflating the two here, but there's a whole geometry with the 10 envelopes and the 8 envelopes, the 10 directions, and so on. And it moves into lotus petals or concentrically surrounding the figures of Radha and Krishna. And right in the middle of Radha and Krishna is the Bija Mantra Kleem. That is the love that conquers both of them. So we don't just worship a god. We don't just worship the supreme goddess. We worship a divine relation. The ultimate supreme divine relation. Radha and Krishna. So we are a tradition of love, which means relationship. And so we have leelas that describe these varieties of relationships. There is no other religious tradition that does this. It's amazing. There are traditions, I have found, that actually sort of know about the 5 rasas. That was a little surprising to me. In certain Christian mystical traditions, they have acknowledged the 5 rasas. But then, do they expand upon them? Do they illuminate these rasas? Not like this tradition. So it is amazing that we have a tradition that celebrates divine love more really than any other tradition in this way, in the intimate connections between the soul and the divinity. This leela of Brahma stealing the cows, the cowherd boys, this is just one among many leelas that demonstrate Krishna's affection. Now, one of the things I tried to talk about on Saturday was that, you know, bhakti is epiphenomenal. Bhakti is, in a sense, after the fact. Bhakti is something that arises precisely because Krishna loves us. It's not that we love Krishna and then Krishna decides whether he wants to love us or not. No, it begins with Krishna. He is already embracing us with his various manifestations, and yet he longs for us. He desires us. This is so poignantly and powerfully, but subtly expressed in the Bhagavad Gita. Here in the Dashama Skanda of the Bhagavata Purana, this celebration and this kind of world of divine love is fully revealed. Well, they're aprakrita leelas, so maybe not fully revealed, but certainly fully celebrated. But in the Gita, it is something that Krishna slowly brings us to. He calls out for us. And Krishna is famous for being the deity who calls us. Notice he is playing the flute. Right now, he is playing the flute. And it is kind of curious that Krishna would be playing the flute. Because the only reason why he would play the flute would be to attract Radha. And yet, she is right there by his side, and he is still playing the flute. But notice that they are not gazing into each other's eyes. They are looking out at us. So together, they are calling us. Everywhere we go, in every temple we see, Radha and Krishna, they are calling out to us. Krishna is the deity who calls us to his heart. This is what our whole tradition is about. Everything else is mere commentary. Krishna is calling us to his heart, and it's a question of whether we respond. The rest is commentary, as far as I'm concerned. Beautiful commentary, extraordinary commentary, but nevertheless commentary. Krishna desires us. He longs for us. He wants more of us. And that is the nature of love. Love does really two things. Just like an embrace. When we embrace someone, we tell them that we love them. We love all that they are. It's a package deal. I love you for... Well, like for example, when I first saw Swavas, I hugged him. And what I was telling him in that hug is, I love you for all your wonderful qualities and all your numerous faults, of which I am unaware, by the way. But I just assumed that they were there. Okay? Whatever is there in Swavas, my dear God brother, I gave him such a big hug, a big squeeze. But in that squeeze, I also was telling him, I want to know you more. So I accept everything that you are, but I want to know you more. Now don't commit me in this way to Swavas. I mean, don't rush me into this relationship, okay? But the idea is that love means full acceptance and the humility before who that person is, on the one hand, and on the other hand, a kind of passion to know that person more, to be closer to that person. These are the two dynamics of prema, two dynamics of love. The first is reveling in the presence of such a person. And the second is the desiring to know that person in something of his absence. And this corresponds to achintya bheda bheda. That on the one hand, Krishna is present everywhere, and this brings out the humility in the bhakta. This celebrative humility. Krishna is everywhere present, everywhere before me. And then this simultaneous realization that Krishna is nowhere to be found. And I must seek Krishna in everything. I must look for him and search for him unceasingly. And in the person of Mahaprabhu, this is what was demonstrated over and over and over. He would see Radha and Krishna, he would run toward Radha and Krishna, and then they would disappear, and then he would fall to the ground weeping. This kind of dialectical presence of the movement between the presence of Krishna and the absence of Krishna. This is love. And this increases ever so much. The realization of the presence of Krishna increases the intensity of the feeling and vision of the absence of Krishna, and vice versa. And they keep intensifying one another synergistically. This is what Mahaprabhu was demonstrating as the ultimate bhakta. And it became so intense in Mahaprabhu that his body just couldn't contain it. And I write about this uncontainable quality of prema as represented by Mahaprabhu in the last chapter of A Living Theology of Krishna Bhakti. The chapter I finish up Tamal Krishna's book. The uncontainable quality of love. And throughout the life of a bhakta, that love becomes so uncontainable that when death finally comes, it's a good thing. Because frankly, the body can't even handle all that love. Like, let me just die and just... Why am I so limited by this body? This is the message that Mahaprabhu gives us. That the love becomes so intense and increases so much that we really need to have other accommodations. It's like moving from a tiny little apartment into, you know, a much bigger dwelling. But in the house of prema, you can never have a big enough house. We have a special opportunity. The Maha Mantra celebrates this love. It is the only mantra. It's a very peculiar mantra in several ways. One, it is universal. Most mantras have certain designated uses. Certain times you chant, certain places. It has to be received in certain ways. The Maha Mantra is universal. It can be chanted anywhere at any time by anyone. Another unusual feature of the Maha Mantra is that it is simply a compilation of names of the divine in the vocative case. There are no other mantras in the vocative case in Sanskrit. Vocative case, meaning, you know, O Krishna, O Rama, O Hara. There is no mantra that is in this way calling out to the divine. There's no other mantra that does that. Only the Maha Mantra. Why is it the Maha Mantra? Because it has these unusual qualities. And it is the most powerful mantra. It also has repetition. No mantra has repeated words in it. No mantra has that. Only the Maha Mantra. So why these unusual qualities? Because the Maha Mantra is a mantra we chant in response to the divine yearning, to the divine love call, to the flute song of Krishna. So our tradition begins with the divine calling to our hearts. Everything else is commentary. Our response is part of that commentary. I was sitting in a little Gurukula class in Alatra. The headmaster there invited me to speak to the children of about nine and ten, I think. And they wanted me to put me on a chair with a garland. I said, no, let me sit on the floor with the kids. I was, you know, trying to bring out my inner child. Suhas, please. Don't laugh at the speaker. Really, it's not nice. In any case, I was trying to get into the child mode, okay? That's what I was trying to do. And I sat down, and I asked the children, I said, so why do we perform devotional service? Why do we chant the Maha Mantra? One child, I heard their parents' voices, you know, indoctrinations coming through them. We chant because we're sinful, and we need to be purified. I said, okay. But I felt myself being in the mood of Mahaprabhu. Go deeper. Chapter 8, Madhya Lila. Go deeper. That's bahya, external. Go deeper. So another child said, we chant because it pleases Krishna. I said, okay, good. But why? I mean, what are we doing when we chant the Maha Mantra? We are calling out to Krishna, right? So why are we calling out to Krishna? I asked the children. Why? Just because we're supposed to? And one child, and I pursued this quite a bit with them, and then one child said, we call out to Krishna because Krishna loves us. I said, thank you. That is exactly right. The Maha Mantra is a response to Krishna's call. And if we look at the Maha Mantra carefully, and we look at the ways Prabhupada has described the Maha Mantra is nothing less than the sonic replication of the Ras Mandala. Notice how the names in the mantra are dancing. I think all of us in here are pretty familiar with the Maha Mantra. They alternate 1-2, 1-2, and then sometimes 2-2, 1-1, then 1-3, 1-3, 1-1, 3-3. I mean, this is a dance. Have you noticed? So ultimately, when we chant the Maha Mantra, we are replicating the Ras Mandala around our hearts. I think that is the ultimate vision to have. Prabhupada says in many places, we all go back and enter the dance. Enter the dance. Why are we dancing in the temple? It reflects the ultimate dance. Why don't we just put a bunch of pews in here, a bunch of chairs? Just cover the place with chairs. The reason we don't do that, it gets in the way of the dance. After all, in Seva Kunj, there are no chairs. Of course, there are a few people in the back sitting in chairs. I'm not going to make any further comment about that. The idea is that everything we do is in response to a divine love call. Krishna is calling us with Radha. Otherwise, he would have no reason to hold that flute and play that flute. They're both gazing out at us, and they're calling us. The concepts of love, and I'll just wind up with this and open up for comments or questions or corrections. I may need some corrections here from any of you, except from Swavas Prabhu. You know, I was giving a Sunday feast in Brooklyn a few years ago. I know that's a bit of a sensitive topic, that location, but I was giving a Sunday feast lecture, and I asked for any comments or questions. One young lady way in the back said, I really am excited about becoming a devotee, a bhakta, but my parents are you know, very committed Christians, and they don't want me to become a devotee. So what do you suggest I do? So I said to her, I said, well, why don't you ask your parents what it is that they love so much about Jesus? What do they love so much about their tradition? And keep inquiring from them. And once you've heard, maybe you'll be able to explain what you love about Krishna. So notice, the process begins with Shravanam. Shravanam leads to Kirtanam. Once you've done plenty of hearing, your parents may be receptive to your Kirtanam. The temple president suddenly raised his hand in the back of the room and said, Garuda, I'm quite surprised at your response here. I mean, if I were her, or if I were she would be the proper grammar, if I were she, I would tell my parents that the God that you're worshiping is Krishna. I'm surprised you wouldn't suggest that. I said, Ram Bhadraji, I said, the reason I didn't suggest that is because no one wants to be told who their God is. That's not a good tact. Let them explain who their God is. I mean, what if I came up to Swavas and said, let me tell you who your wife is? I mean, at that point, Swavas should take some action. What business is it of mine to tell Swavas who his wife is to him? If we can't even do that, how can we tell someone who their God is? And as soon as we do that, or attempt to do that, we are eclipsing dialogue. Dialogue is finished. There is no more dialogue. And if there's one thing this world needs, is dialogue. We need this process of shravanam. Let's not take it for granted. There's not enough hearing in the world. In our sangha, we need to do more hearing, to be more attentive, to be more sensitive to the thoughts and feelings of others. Just to promote our own thoughts and feelings is, frankly, lust. It's egocentric. It's only concern for what I am in the universe. But let me connect more with the real universe by hearing what someone else has to say and creating a relationship, a dialogue. This is bhakti. Bhakti means sharing. So we have such jewels in our tradition, really, to cash in beautiful ways. I mean, I had a Christian tell me who I should love a long time ago. This happened in 2005. The reason I remember this is because my first book just came out. And so I was getting a haircut in a mall from a very nice Korean lady. And I was a little bit early. And I said, I'm here, Casey. And she said, oh, you're here for your haircut. You're early. 5 minutes. 5 minutes, Gram. 5 minutes. I said, fine, I'll be across the hall in the jewelry store. And so I went across, and I'm looking at the jewelry, because I don't like malls very much. So I'm looking at these pure gemstones. And of course, I'm thinking of all the metaphors and the way they translate into Shastra. But a saleswoman by the name of Deborah, she had a name tag, comes over to me and says, oh, how are we today? I said, fine. She said, are we looking for some jewelry for the wife? I said, no, actually, I'm just here. I'm just waiting for a haircut across the hall here. I said, okay. She asked, what do you do? I said, I'm a university professor. She said, what subject? I said, of comparative religion. She said, oh, have you written any books? I said, as a matter of fact, I just came out with a book. Yeah. And there are many books on the subject matter on which I focus. She said, well, I bet no one's going back to God reading your book now, are they? I was a little taken aback. I said, excuse me? She said, Professor, do you know what it means to suffer? I said, I'm beginning to find out. She said, if you let Jesus into your heart, then, and I said, excuse me, Deborah, let me just stop you right there, because I know where you're going, and let me just make it real quick for you. I would rather go to that God's hell than to love a God who felt he had to force me to love him. Is that clear? She was kind of stunned. At that point, Casey came out and said, Graham, your haircut. Deborah, it's been nice talking to you. I'm going halfway across the hall, and Deborah yells out to me. She said, Professor, I don't feel forced to love Jesus. I turned around and I said, good. But it's not beneath you to force others now, is it? Anyway, no one messes with me. Once my wife, in our house in Florida, where it's out in the middle of nowhere in Alachua, it's out, you know. And we don't ever get anyone coming to the front door, you know. Properties are on big acre lots and so on. Anyway, suddenly the doorbell rings. I said, who's there? Who could be ringing the door? She said, well, actually, I invited a very nice couple to talk to you. A very nice couple to talk to me? This just doesn't sound like my wife, you know. When did she invite a very nice couple to talk to me? And then she confesses that actually she had talked to them previously and they wanted to meet me because they are Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, usually I'm game for this kind of thing. You know, I love the Mormon boys, the Jehovah's Witnesses, right? But I just wasn't quite in the mood, but I said, okay, let's do it. Okay. So we invite them in, this nice older couple. And, of course, my wife said, be nice to them. And I'm looking at her like, I am a nice person. And I was amazed I had to remind her of that. But she kind of knows I can be a little pointed at times. So they're sitting there, and they're asking me about me, but I'm asking really about them. I'm saying, how did you come to the Jehovah's Witness path, you know? So I know we're talking, and it's going very nicely. My wife's sitting next to me on the couch. They're sitting across from us. And then I said, so what is it that you really love the most about your tradition? At that point, I get a little bit of a kick under the couch because my wife feels like I'm escalating a little bit. Okay? Because she knows how I kind of move into these things. Okay? So they said, in unison, this couple said, the truth. Yeah. It's like shutting a door. The truth. I said, you both love the truth. In other words, you both love having the truth? They said, yes. We have the truth. I said, so you both have the truth, and we don't have the truth. Is that right? And you're here to give us your truth. They said, well, it's not our truth, it's the truth. I said, well, you know, I've been interviewing people long enough in this world, and then I get another kick because she knows where I'm about to go with this. And, you know, I know other people who say they have the truth too. And that would cancel out your truth. And you're sitting here saying your truth cancels out their truth and even our truth. And now I get a real kick because I'm coming in for the close. Okay? And I said, you know, if we don't take up your truth, we're going to your hell, aren't we? They said, yes. Very nice, very sweetly. They said, yes, you're going to our hell. I said, here's the problem. All of us are going to everyone else's hells. There are so many hells that I'm destined for, I can't even count them. My wife squirming on the couch. They're kind of looking at me with sort of a kind of a gaze. They're not quite getting it. So I decided not to take this any further, but to let them know that I enjoyed speaking with them and they gave me a copy of their Bible, their certain translation. Dialogue. It's important. to really hear. I don't think they were really hearing. They just were displaying. They were on display in my home because my wife invited them in. But it was very interesting. We need to be open to what people have to say, but hopefully they will be open from our openness to hear all that we have to offer. But when someone's not receptive, there's no point in wasting time. I've also seen Prabhupada do that. Why explain anything? It's just not worth it. Yet the Gita says this too. Don't try to disrupt the conceptions that people have that they're so attached to. But in whatever response we give, let us be loving and caring. Let us show them that we are open. They are closed, and when they're ready to open, we're ready to share with them the great treasures of what we have. And we have so many beautiful treasures. Wonderful treasures. So, let me just open up for any comments or questions. Let me take Rameshwar, then we'll... Boy, did I say that much that was wrong? I mean, are these the corrections? Or let's see Rameshwar first. Yes, good. This reminds me,
can you repeat that question?
Yeah, okay, because it wasn't right for people in the cyber land. The question is, as 1,000th the tip of the size of a hair in this body and going through many births, and Rameshwar is sounding very Christian, in my opinion. I lived so many births, and I've been disgusting, engaged in so many, You see, because in the Christian tradition, the soul, a creationist conception of the soul, which says that the soul begins at conception and goes on eternally from there. We have an emanationist conception of the soul, which means that the soul is as been eternal prior to the body, during the body, and after the body. So that's a different... Right there, we've got different conceptions. The emanationist conception says that the soul is pure, is perfect and pure, and it's been covered. This we know. The creationist conception says the soul is flawed. Flawed. I gave a lecture out in the Bible Belt. Actually, it was the buckle of the Bible Belt. In Mississippi State University, a big, I cleverly called my lecture, is religion one or is one religion right? Little brain twister there to keep the Midwesterners busy, you know? But they felt obligated during this lecture, I mean, after my lecture, to have a local Christian minister respond to my talk. Where basically I'm telling them that the Christianity is not the only religion in the world, and that there are actually some incredibly powerful traditions elsewhere. The minister came up afterwards and basically started a 10-minute discourse in response to mine, and he said, We are filthy, dirty rags, quoting the Hebrew Bible. We are as if a filthy rag. Now, of course, when I heard this, I kind of gasped. And he's talking about the soul. He's not just talking about the body, the soul in the body. He's talking about the soul. Now, this is the difference. This is the difference. The soul in Christianity is disgusting. Can you imagine walking around as not just in a body, which has its issues, but as a disgusting, filthy soul? I think I need a drink of water. I mean, that's the difference, Rameshwarji. I mean, the soul, we have the soul is part of God in our tradition. Now, I see that how their vision of the flawed soul works into their rasa. Okay, and so I'm not criticizing them, but that is certainly not our conception. But we get a lot of that being in the West. You know, we tend to be. I mean, the Christians have some traditions where they like to actually, you know, self-flagellation. You know, they like to, you know, since we are disgusting and so on. But that's because they are disgusting down to their very soul. So I've actually offered to help Christians get, you know, hurt themselves, and you know, I've offered to you know, whip them and whatever they need, you know. I mean, I thought of it as a kind of service that I could provide. As a theologian, I appreciate their position, but that's not what we do. We don't have, like, you know, canings anywhere here. Do we, Swavaz? No. Okay. We don't. Okay. I looked over at Swavaz. I wasn't. His expression didn't reveal one way or the other, so I was a little nervous. But no, we don't have that here. We look at each other as wonderful, beautiful souls. And even the whole Hindu tradition, when we say namaste, that means I honor the true you and the divine presence within you. This is beautiful. Namaste. You know, I guess the equivalent kind of greeting in Christianity might be something like, you are disgusting. Hello, glad to meet you, you disgusting being, you. It doesn't work for us, obviously. That's why we're here, as so many Westerners. Look how many Westerners there are. There are very few Indians here. But it works for us because this is the vision we want. We want a God not of just mere judgment and redemption, which responds to this disgusting creature that is absolutely hopeless, which makes, of course, divine grace very amazing for that tradition, no doubt. Okay, I'm not tossing them out. But we worship a God who is supremely beautiful, supremely playful, and supremely delightful. Madan Mohan, Govinda, Gopinatha. Three principal deities, Vrindavan. Beautiful, playful, and delightful. You might want to recite these words throughout the day. Our Lord is beautiful, playful, and delightful. And we have the pure soul somewhere in these crazy existences that we've been in to join that, those leelas of beauty and playfulness and love. Okay. Oh, is it late?
Do you want to do one question? I guess,
but one more?
We have things that we have to do.
I don't have anything to do. I'm here vacationing, Swavaz. I thought this is my vacation. I have been misrepresented. It's been misrepresented. This Prabhupada
says. They need to leave, they should go.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I'm on vacation. So anyone wants to join me on my vacation, are free to do so. Okay, so first, should we go? Do you have to leave? Or? Yes, please.
Once a Christian told me that I was going eternally to hell. And I asked him, is God love? And he said, yes, he is. Then I told him, if God is love, wouldn't he give me another chance? And he didn't know what to say.
Yeah. You know, I have, of course, hundreds of students every year. And most of them are probably Christians. And sometimes I just have this telepathic sense that certain Christian students of mine are definitely not going to heaven. And I tell them that. It really seems like you're not going to heaven. So you know what my suggestion is? That you convert to Islam. Because in Islam, that their hell is not eternal. So it's a better deal. I'm telling you this because I want to impress to you how compassionate I am. I am averting an eternal, you know, dismal situation. So in Islam you can actually get out of their hell, but in Christianity you cannot. So it's pretty bad. Let's go to Chandrasekhar. The mic is slowly coming to you.
Thank you, Prabhu. You mentioned that in Seva Kunj there's no pews.
Am I wrong?
I don't know.
But oh, yeah.
It made me think of what Gargamuni Prabhu says, namely that before Suhas Prabhu was here, when Prabhupada was at this temple, apparently there were pews, and
there
he didn't
pews.
Want them removed. And so then I thought, well, also, there's probably no LCD screens in the spiritual world, nor microphones, nor
no, I think there are.
Social media.
There's one of those. But anyway, yes.
So I'm coming to this point of Yukta Vairagya versus the theme of imitating, you know, the culture of Krishna and so on. And so it seems like the lines are blurred.
Mm-hmm.
On the one side, we're warned not to imitate the sahaja. You know, we criticize the sahajas for imitating instead of following. And yet, as you pointed out, you know, the Maha Mantra is a reenactment of the spiritual world. The very notion of relationship is something that we espouse and emphasize down here in the material world as
yes.
An ontological reflection of what goes on in the spiritual world. So who draws the lines? Where are the lines distinguished between imitation and, you know, practically spreading the Sankirtan movement with Yukta Vairagya, not necessarily
okay.
imitating?
Good. Now, so what the main imitation you're concerned with would be what?
The general, you know, general. I'd like to avoid specific examples, but just more sticking
because,
to the principles.
I mean, in one sense, the whole this whole world is a kind of imitation. Now, Prabhupada calls it a perverted reflection. I call it metonymic reality. And what I think all of these are really pointing to is the way that nothing here can be here without it being in its ultimate form there. So why do people love sports so much? Because in the divine there's playfulness. Now, maybe they don't know how to be so playful here, they need to have it often accompanied with lots of beer. I once went to a ball game. I went only once, and that will be the last time. But all they do is yell and scream at people down on the field, and I don't know what they're doing on the field. It seemed very boring to me. And then they're drinking at the same time. And they think they're having a good time. And I think probably part of them really is having a good time, but part of them is kind of like escaping misery. So it's a mixed. This world's very mixed, you know? It's mixed. So there are things, everything here is reflecting something of the divine. So the question is, we may want things here to look more like the divine, to remind us more of the divine. I mean, honestly, I, you know, since I'm in California and I'm not used to being here, I was actually going to come here today for Bhagavatam class in my bathing suit. I just thought that was inappropriate, though. It occurred to me, I walked part of the way out of my room and said, whoops, okay, go back in, get in your dhoti, and come down. And be context sensitive. So, you know, in the university, I don't dress this way. Because I'm context sensitive. I remember when I was leaving University of Chicago to attend Harvard University, because Rupanuga called me up one day and said, Garuda, look, no one else is ever going to go to a university, okay? No one's crazy enough to go to the university as a devotee. Only you are. So, you know what? People in the know how powerful University of Chicago is, but it's not got the name of Harvard. You need to go to Harvard. So I went to Harvard. But he said, you're not going with a shaved head and a shika. Because that's not acceptable. Of course, it's a free country. You can do it. But is it really conducive to what you're trying to do? So he got me to cut my shika. I had a lovely shika. It was very long. I used to roll it up in a hangman's noose. I'm sorry? Rupanuga Prabhu. The original Rupanuga, right? So he told me, you're not going that way. And I used to go in kurta and not dhoti, but yogi pants. And, you know, I might even wear something like this when I went to Chicago. But when I got to Harvard, no. I looked like a normal person. And of course, in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it says, Rupa Goswami says, that a pure devotee can appear just like an ordinary person. Now, I'm not suggesting a lot of purity here, but the point is, it's perfectly fine. I think it's about context sensitivity. I think that's, and it's part of, it issues forth from a relationship, the way we, you seem to refer to the pews that were originally here, right? That Prabhupada liked the pews, okay? Yeah. Okay. That's fine. So we have our ISKCON information center right there in the back of the room. That's good. But of course there would be no problem with having pews here. It can happen. There's nothing that ultimately limits Krishna Bhakti. We are the ones that limit Krishna Bhakti. But ultimately, I think Prabhupada was always very innovative and creative, and I think we can draw from that. So I don't think we have to be too concerned about imitation unless it becomes something that drains the substance. Substance is what we need to be guaranteeing. So I don't know if that,
thank you,
if that helps or not. Yeah.
Thank you, Guru Puma. I loved your class.
Thank you. And
I feel that your class is an expression, as is your whole life, of your love for all of us, meaning devotees and non-devotees alike. So I'd like to thank you for the wonderful gift that you've given us today. I have one teeny little question. What does the word penultimate mean? Because I heard you say earlier in the class...
Did I say that word?
Yeah, I think you did.
I have no idea what it means.
Oh.
No, of course I do. Penultimate means second to last.
Oh, okay.
And anti-penultimate, not anti, but anti-penultimate means third to last. So you can use these words to intimidate people you meet.
Okay.
That's why I offered them to you.
So that was correct. You said Vatsalya Rasa was the penultimate rasa. It means
yes.
It's the second to
right.
Gotcha.
The Sringara rasa. Right.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Chandrasekhar reminds me that I even put together sometimes neologisms. And, you know, typically Western traditions are called monotheistic. You know, monotheistic. And I find a lot of devotees will say, well, we're monotheistic too. And I said, oh, I don't know. It doesn't really cover it. So I came up with an incredibly bulky, protracted phrase, which apparently is caught a little bit with preachers like Chandrasekharji, who enters into academic and intellectual arenas, and other devotees have also reminded me that I wrote this once. But I came up with the term to characterize our theology as a polymorphic bimonotheism. Okay, think of it. Polymorphic means many forms. Okay, we know Krishna has many forms. This is a very learned audience here. Everyone knows Krishna has many forms. And we're focused on the singular deity, but yet the singular deity is two. Bimonotheism, a kind of split monotheism of the divine feminine and the divine masculine. So I call it the polymorphic bimonotheism. And just speaking to Chandrasekharji the other day, I said, you know, we could actually call it the polymorphic trimonotheism, because Mahaprabhu is the combination of Radha and Krishna's love. So we could even say trimonotheism, but, you know, we can start getting really tricky about stuff. But, so words are important to describe what we are. But let's not just merge ourselves with the characterizations that are given typically to Christianity. Because we are not the same. We're very different. That's why we're here. Yeah. And yes, thank you for reminding me of that, Chandrasekhar. Yeah,
thank you, Prabhu. Your class, most of the class was about, we are about love. Our tradition is about love. So, at the Sunday feast, there was a guest who came for the first time. And he was a mixture of Christian, atheist, agnostic. And he posed this question, and then he said, who is that father who will put, who loves his children, and he will put drugs any place or any poison for his children to get it? So God is omniscient, he said. He knows everything. So what is that love? Can you give an answer?
Okay, let me just make sure I understand the question. So he's asking what kind of God would allow for... drugs and temptations and bad things and whatnot.
He knows that these children will get into that, so he wouldn't do it.
Right.
So how come the omniscient God does things like that? Can you answer?
I can't answer to it, but I can respond to it. And my response would be that freedom is the bedrock of love. Freedom.
Even for the children?
Children that need the guidance of parents. Now, that the love manifests through parents and guidance and knowledge. Prabhupada says the parents are the first guru. Okay? They're the first guru. Mother and father are the first guru. So, but when we were adults, by that point, we should be able to discern what is healthy, what is not healthy. And you know, again, the question of free will versus determinism. The more we are raised into sattva, the more free will we have. The more we go down toward tamasa existence, the less free will we have. So, for example, if I came here, if I drank before I came here, and I don't mean drinking water, I mean drinking alcohol, and I came here, you know, what do you call it, bombed, stoned, I don't know what to call it, drunk on the Vyasasana, what kind of free will, how much could I, as good intention as I may have, really, how much control do I have over myself? None. But if I come here with great clarity, I'm clear-headed, come to Mangala Arati, sing the divine names, you know, connect with wonderful souls here, as dirty as we all are. Okay, I got this from Rameshwar. Yeah, exactly. But that's fine. No, it's good. It was good. Yeah. So, but seriously, I mean, you know, with that, we're all uplifted, and we can learn from one another. We can relate and interact, and be sensitive and aware of one another. But if I'm drunk, I'm not aware of you. I'm not even aware of me. I'm not aware of anything. This is an awful existence. That is when things get kind of dirty and low and awful. But being bright and lit up with devotion and with affection for one's fellow God brothers and God sisters, and a love for the process, I mean, well, is there anything better? I mean, I don't know of anything better. So it's freedom. Freedom must, this work, the cost of love in this world is freedom. And there are some human beings which abuse that freedom heavily. And those who are the recipients of such abuse are the unwitting martyrs of love. The awful killings in the elementary school. In Virginia Tech, 30 people, some 30 students were blown away by someone's gun. These are the unwitting recipients, the unwitting martyrs of love, the freedom. When we're not free, we cannot love. It's the cost of love. That's why this world is very, very mixed and very troubled. Because there are many, many destroyed, very tormented hearts out there. So, it's part of what we got. It's part of what we got. Yes.
In all these different arguments that you made, at the core is
you're blaming God. Blaming God for
instead
the
of yourself.
Right.
And that was the end of that.
See, we have now. You see, in Western traditions, there might be more cause to blame God because I don't know. You know that song? He knows when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. I don't know that song. So be good for goodness sake. Something like that. I mean, God is, in the Christian tradition, is stalking us and judging us. Krishna is not a God of judgment. He's not a God. He's not a God of jealousy. He's a generous God. He's a loving God. So we have God punishes in the Western traditions, karma, the cosmos. There's cosmic justice. Krishna has nothing to do with that action and reaction dimension of existence. That's up to us. And we can rise beyond that to pure devotion and be totally and intimately connected with divinity. But we understand that when bad things happen, it's part of a kind of overall cosmic situation. So, it's not God. God is protected in our tradition. But frankly, the person who has to blame God needs to be, well, frankly, a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim. Because in those traditions, that's what it's about. If we're all born equally, why are some people born in well-to-do families? And why are some people not? What about Mozart? Look at Mozart. Do you know what it means to compose a symphonic piece of music? And he did it at the age of 7 and people are still playing that? That's equal? Why am I not? I tried composing a symphony last week and no one's playing it. And it's really good, actually. But anyway, no one's paying any attention to it. But the point is that we have a different worldview. We have a really different worldview. So, I think we should stop because, like Swava said, there are things to do, places to go, people to see. And prasadam to honor. I think that's the most important event, yes. Thank you very much, Hare Krishna. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Here. Look at all these phones people are donating to me. It's great. I could use another. Oh, this one looks really nice. This one's a little bigger. I think I'll take this one.